From years of anxiety to warrior and mentor, Bradley Robinson created the Anxiety Project to help you end your anxiety naturally. Let's mold the new you and let's end anxiety together.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Anxiety Project podcast. Welcome to episode 282. And we're diving into depression, the biology behind your depression, how anxiety is related to depression, as well as solutions to overcoming debilitating depression and anxiety. Much of my notes today are derived from Robert Sapolsky's recent work. He is a professor at Stanford University. He's a neuroscientist. He's an author. He studies biology. He's an incredible dude, and I hope that you check out his work. But I'll leave a link to his lecture below, by the way. It's a two-hour lecture. If you want to dive more in-depth in depression, check it out. I highly recommend it. So today, let's look at extensively into depression and how this is the number one medical disability in our current culture, according to the WHA, which is, you know, it's not a surprise to me because I notice within not only my coaching practices, but just regular life, just having my, being awake, being alert to the functioning of today's society, and that depression is running rampant and it's growing. And it, severe depression affects 15 to 18% of people. 80% are never diagnosed, which is interesting. One third are helped by medications. One third don't seek help. And then one third don't use medications. And then one third uses medications but has severe side effects and it doesn't work. So depression is mainly determined by low socioeconomic status. And that's a major, major predictor. And that makes sense because if you're low in the competence hierarchy, there's this natural occurrence, low serotonin, natural occurrence that you're going to feel depressed. And Peterson points that out as well in his lectures. He says that if you give defeated lobsters SSRIs, what happens is they have more confidence and they kind of go back into the ring and fight another day. And that's really interesting. But Sapolsky also he states that there is a silver lining to depression. I think that's the case. When someone is suffering so deeply from this and overcome depression, that they have a stronger appreciation for family, finding, and they find faith, which is also like a structure. They build on a structure and they build on their competency overcoming and figuring out this depression. And that's the thing, it builds your character. And you might find a better partner because of that. You know, you go through a breakup, you go through a loss, some sort of tragedy, and maybe the family comes closer together. Maybe you find the resources within you and in your external world to navigate yourself through such difficult times. And that's also a really important thing to keep note of. And then trait neuroticism, part of the big five personality model, you're more susceptible to anger, aggression, anxiety, negative emotion, poor emotional regulation, that self-consciousness. Peterson also points out as well that people who are overly self-conscious experience a higher degree of negative emotion because there's no difference between being so self-aware and negative emotion. I mean, even when you know that to be the case, when you're talking with somebody and you're just so fixated on how you look, is there food on my face? How am I acting? Does the other person think I'm weird? And so strong negative emotion. And I am high in trait neuroticism. So it's been a challenge for me to work with my prefrontal cortex to reframe the narrative that I continuously play out in my head. And that's part of the CBT work, which we will get into later. And it helps people navigate themselves out of depression. It's a really powerful tool. I highly recommend it. It's something I studied when I was overcoming my anxiety disorder. But let's talk about the major symptoms of depression. One is anhedonia. This is so fascinating. And it's the inability to experience pleasure. Pleasure. So no libido, you know, no positive emotion when something good happens. You know, you think to yourself, well, this is a fun experience. I'm at a theme park with my family, or I'm at the park with my family. I'm doing something that would seem positive to the average person. But to me, I don't feel any emotion whatsoever. This is also something I experienced with my anxiety disorder, because at one point I was crossing the road and I was in this depersonalization state. It was really overwhelming. And a car just flew right past me, and in my head I was like, oh my god, I almost got hit by a car. I wasn't paying attention. I was so self-centered and so self-aware of my overwhelming anxiety symptoms that I didn't even recognize this car. But I don't feel like overwhelmed that I almost got hit. It was almost this numbness. And so anhedonia, huge to understand, and it affects people with depression, and it affects people. It's a factor with anxiety as well. And so you no longer look on the bright side. It's always this constant rumination, this constant obsessing over what makes you sad, negative memories. And then another symptom of depression is grief, guilt. The grief part, very interesting, because, you know, the person suffering from anxiety says the narrative of, well, I'm privileged. I have a home. I have food in the fridge. I have a loving family. You know, my work is going great. I should be feeling positive, but I don't deserve this. I'm feeling very negative. I'm feeling down. I'm feeling empty, and I feel bad because I'm wasting my life while I should be feeling happy. That's the guilty side of it. It's this victim mentality, and they start to feel guilty the more you play out this mentality and this narrative in your day-to-day, the more you lean on people for reassurance and help, and you feel like a burden because your conscience is telling you that you're feeling or you're acting in a kind of burdensome way, and you're not manifesting your potential. You're not getting a grip over your reality. And depression, for people, it's the lack of control that really gets them into that deep, deep depression. They just want to gain control over their external and internal world. They just want control, and that they feel currently out of control. The third symptom of depression is distorted cognitive functioning, difficulty remembering, unfocused, living solely on primitive functioning, not motivated. And so you have the thoughts of, why bother? Where am I going? This is continuous. And then what's interesting about that is, when people fall into these negative states, their reticular activating system, which you know, that system where you're paying attention to what's relevant in your surroundings. So you're looking for a new car, and recently you just got interested in Tesla. Something about watching an Elon Musk interview, and then you're thinking about buying a new car. You're looking at Teslas online, and then all of a sudden you're walking down the street and you start to notice Teslas, a blue, and maybe the blue one because your favorite color is blue, and you're paying attention to what's emotionally relevant, what's relevant right now. Or you used to be a delivery driver. I like this example. You used to work at a delivery job, and then when a FedEx truck drives by, you notice the truck, right? It's like, oh, you know, like I used to do that. It's relevant. It's emotionally relevant. And people suffering from anxiety do this too, where they're paying attention to, and they're overhearing someone, oh my God, you know, Susie got a diagnosis of something, you know, life-threatening, and then you perk up and you look, or something on the news or a billboard of like, have you went to your doctors lately and got your urine checked or something like that, and you're perking up and you feel emotionally charged from these signals in your immediate surroundings. So your reticular activating system is catching things that are emotionally fitting with your inside narrative. And then the more this inside narrative runs itself, it starts to become a consistent way of being. And that is your default mode network. Your default mode network is what's consistent, right? What's the pattern? What's the pattern? And people with this negative rumination, they live day to day with this consistent pattern. And so people with depression, they overgeneralize the negative. And that's all they see. They only see negatives. Not only is my present situation uncertain, but my past and my future is uncertain as well. And they have a bias towards negative emotion. Like I said, the reticular activating system is this bias. They're only paying attention to the negatives, and this can be their default way of being. And they shoot to the most abstract conclusion, right? So instead of when they get a test back, or when they get examined by the doctor, they go to the most abstract train of thought, which is, I'm a bad person. Why bother? I'll never get it. I shouldn't even be alive. Rather than say, you know what, I didn't do well on this test. What are the micro routines that'll help me pass this exam the next time? I'm not a bad person. Maybe, you know, I'm not very skillful at preparing a meal. So I just have to practice the micro routines of preparing that meal. So I have to re-strategize, okay, the ingredients. Maybe I missed one ingredient. Maybe I need to buy better ingredients. Maybe I needed to, you know, I need to look up a more effective recipe. Maybe I'm, you know, even accepting the fact that you're a fool, that you're new at this is humbling. And so that self-acceptance, doesn't snowball so far into, well, I'm a bad person, I shouldn't even exist. And depressed people go there. They go, well, I failed at this, I'm always a failure, and I shouldn't even exist. And, you know, they can really get going. And that's a good thing to know. The fourth symptom of major depression is rumination. We already touched a little bit on that. And you can't stop the negative thoughts from playing out in your mind. And your prefrontal cortex, your more evolved part of the brain, has to work harder to counter these thoughts, because your default mode network is running the overplayed record. You've practiced negative thinking for a long time. The next symptom is psychomotor slowing. So you don't have energy, you don't have motivation to do anything. So sleep is disrupted. You wake up earlier than usual because of that. Lack of motivation makes sense, because low serotonin, not having any goals to pursue. You can't see a future. You can't see where you're going. It's going to create this hopelessness. So, the psychomotor slowing, you have to also note that there's a loss of appetite. Libido is gone. So that's also related to anhedonia. Very interesting. No positive emotion, right? The person depressed, no positive emotion. There's no goal. There's no motivation. There's no energy to drive this person forward. They're in this stuck, hopeless place. Let's talk about the types of depression, also laid out by Sapolsky in his great lecture. He talks about reactive depression. Something bad happens, you feel depressed, but you gradually recover over the week or 2 weeks. It doesn't stick around for a long period. And that occurs to all of us at some point in our life. And you know that, I know that especially. And then there's endogenous depression. You fall into depression when nothing bad has happened to you. And it's coming from within. It's not external. And it's, I think, typically autoimmune. It's autoimmune. A lot of people who have an inflamed body or poor gut microbiome, they're more susceptible to depression. This is current research that I'm so fascinated in, and it's something I've noticed within myself going on a ketogenic diet. This was the icing on the cake for me when it came to anxiety and depression, was moving from a standard all-American diet to very whole foods, meat, eggs, if you want to include vegetables, fruit, nuts, some seeds, whatever, you can do that too. I did all that, but I felt better when I was minimizing what I was consuming, sugar, grains, all of that. And I felt much, much better. There's so much research on that. I highly recommend you look into keto and carnivore for healing things like depression and anxiety and any autoimmune problem. And it's very much correlated to depression. I'll tell you that. Cycles of depression. Now, people, depression comes and goes throughout the year. They'll have a depressive episode. They'll come back from that, and then it'll spike again, and then it lingers, and then it comes and goes throughout the year in waves. And then there's seasonal affective disorder, seasonal depression. It links to melatonin imbalance, and light exposure makes sense because when the winter months come, people feel more tired. The days, you know, shift where it's more darker for most of the year, like in Canada here. And seasonal depression was something I used to get. And it's the lack of sun, like I said, but also I think it's this shadowy element of the winter months coming where you're going to have to struggle through a dark days where it's minus 20 and you're just trying to get to work and you're shivering and you're cold. It's just this, this frustration around the fact that you're going to have to suffer through months of snow and minus temperatures. And that was something I battled with, but how I overcame it was for me, I just kept my standards the same. So for example, people take cold showers. It's easy to take cold showers, cold plunges, or to walk and run outside in the summer. It's easy. It's easier. But when this winter months come, I noticed for me that it got much harder to maintain those standards. But I decided, you know what? I'm going to continue to take my ice baths or take ice baths into wind all through the year, no days off. So I decided that. And I noticed that the cold months, taking ice bath in the morning, yeah, it's brutal for a few minutes. But when you get out and you go outside in the minus 15 degree weather, I noticed that my body was already adjusted. I didn't feel so defeated by the cold. Like I didn't have to rely on hot showers. I didn't have to rely so much on bundling myself in 10 layers and things like that. I felt like my body was way more prepared and used to that cold weather, and that helped immensely. Let's talk about the link between anxiety and depression, because these go hand in hand. Anxiety is anhedonia and hyperarousal, whereas depression is, anhedonia, and then depression is anhedonia plus hypoarousal, and that's interesting. Most anxiety comes first for most of us before the depression. And that's also interesting because anxiety is, well, I'm somewhere I don't understand, so I must be hyper alert to navigate my way through. Something in your life is so relevant to you that it has become of top value, top priority to you. Too much uncertainty, it can defeat people. They give up. They can't navigate their way through the cave. They can't confront the dragon. That makes sense, doesn't it? It makes sense. So people can fall into depression after the anxiety phase. The anxiety phase is, oh my God, I'm in a place I don't understand. This change is occurring. How am I going to contend with it? And then the depression comes when it's like, oh my God, I just don't have the resources. I just don't have the skill set. Oh, I just don't have the motivation. I feel hopeless. I feel like I'm being backed into a corner and I can't navigate my way out of here. That's huge. Depression comes when you feel debilitated by the uncertainty. You don't have the resources to work through it. You feel hopeless as a consequence. You feel defeated. And this results in low serotonin, low mood. Serotonin works with melatonin to help control when you sleep and wake up. And so no wonder you're not getting a good night's rest. Also, the amygdala inhibits the dopaminergic system. Very interesting. The amygdala activates when you show someone a picture of something fearful. But what's most fearful to a depressed person is things that can make them sadder. Things that can make them sadder. And I've been around my friend who's been depressed most of his life, had these massive periods of major depression. And I took him with my fiance at the time, now wife, we went to a movie, and it was very dark, very disturbing movie. Mentally disturbing, and it was a fantastic movie. But my friend, who's so susceptible to depression, the movie affected him more than it affected us, because we're more emotionally stable. We're better situated in our lives than he is, and so the movie really affected him in a really dark way. And so just keep that in mind, that things that, you know, a movie makes anyone anxious and uneasy, but to someone who's more susceptible and who doesn't have their life under control and regulated, it's affecting them to a much greater degree. Let's talk about serotonin for a second. It's a neurotransmitter. Sapolsky talks about how antidepressants work on serotonin, like SSRIs. Serotonin is released from the neuron receptor, and the SSRI blocks the reuptake pump. And so the serotonin sticks around longer in the synapse, making someone feel less depressed. The problem, though, this is my note here, is people rely on drugs. They rely on it, but they fail to pursue any change to help their situation. So SSRIs can be useful if you take them, if you're in a very, very dark place. It helps people to maintain some sort of sanity while they work through their really dark, dark, hopeless thoughts. And they seek psychotherapeutic help, intervention at the same time. It has its place. It can help 1/3 of the 80% who suffer through the serious depression. It's good as a last resort, I believe. But, you know, bear in mind that it can have its side effects. The 1/3 of the people that take it, they really do suffer from the side effects, and it really affects them. But look, it could help you. It could help you. And if you're really in a dark place, you're really feeling hopeless, and you're in that corner, depression is debilitating. You need to get help. If SSRIs is something that you're interested in, or you feel like it could help you, by all means. Let's talk about dopamine for a second here, because earlier I said the amygdala inhibits the dopaminergic system. And what's dopamine is, well, it's the anticipation, right? Because before, you've stumbled upon something rewarding, right? And then the brain tracks the process to this thing that you acquired. So you get this reward, and then, but it, there has to be a signal beforehand there. And what is the work required to obtain this reward? And so once you traverse this process of attaining that spike in dopamine, the brain goes, okay, what's the process to get it again? And then, so there's a signal. And so then the dopamine is the anticipation towards that work, towards that reward. It's the work, it's the anticipation. An addiction, a habit, is cue, craving, response, reward. There's always a cue, and then there's that craving. So for me, in my pornography addiction, I would know that when I'm feeling uneasy, or when I was alone, it was this cue that I was giving myself this all clear, or this burst of dopamine to go and watch pornography. It was this, it's just around the corner. It's exciting, working towards the reward. And if you're not willing to work, then there's no reward. And a lot of people who don't have a goal in life and a path in front of them, there's no positive emotion, because positive emotion comes when you see yourself progressing towards a goal, right? And the goal could be as simply as watching pornography, or going to your favorite bakery, or the cigarette, whatever it is. Let's talk about the brain, how the brain works. So there's three layers. The one is the reptilian brain. So it's self-regulation, hot, cold, hungry, breathing, heart rate. That's the brain stem. The second layer is the mammalian brain, emotional brain, limbic system, anger, amygdala, hypothalamus, emotional brain. The third layer is the human brain, the more evolved part of the brain. That's the prefrontal cortex, cognitive brain, problem solving, rational dialogue. The prefrontal cortex, it's less active in depressed and anxious people. This part counteracts the rumination. It counteracts the default mode network. It helps you to problem solve. But with people with depression and anxiety, they have trouble problem solving. Their amygdala takes over, their emotional brain takes over, their rational brain, and it's running the show, and they feel out of control. And there is a way using CBT to help one control what they can't seem to control. And so let's talk about the solutions, because we talked about a lot about depression, about anxiety, but more importantly, what you need to know, by the way, because it'll help you better understand your situation, that you aren't alone, that there is a solution, that this is known research, and it's part of being a human, it's part of being a fallible human being, is to go through these ups and downs in your life. I'll certainly have mine going forward, as you will. But we can modify the stress response. We can work so that the depression and anxiety doesn't do us in as much as it has to. And so first, how much are you willing to sacrifice? Are you willing to give up much of your instant gratification for you to be better tomorrow and throughout the week and months and years? And first, the stress response is active because of our desire for control, because there's a lack of control. And so you need an outlet for frustration. You need to go on walks, separate yourself from distractions. You need to go to the gym. You need to exercise. You need an outlet, okay? Meditation, You need to slow down. You need a sense of predictability. You need a routine. You need a structure. You can't be flailing about. You can't be waking up at random times of your day. It helps dysregulate your sleep cycle and your emotional state, stability. There needs to be a shift in your perception over your situation and your life. And then you need social support. You need resources because you can't do it alone. You can't do it alone. You don't have enough internal resources to navigate the complexity of your situation. And so CBT helps. Cognitive behavioral therapy helps. Depression is a cognitive overgeneralization, learned helplessness. Your past determined where you are now and where you will always be. That's learned helplessness. Your past determined where you are now and where you will always be. But that is not true, that your brain is neuroplastic, that you can rewire your brain. A set mindset is someone who is in their bubble of comfort, conformity, repetition. But to break out of that, you have to look into the drawers of your mind. You have to look outside of what you already know. And that's something I did in my recovery, was I looked online to see if people suffered the same thing I did. And lo and behold, many people did. I found someone I related to. I studied them. You study them. Because for me, I didn't have the resources necessary to overcome my anxiety and depression. I did not have those resources. My parents didn't know anything more than I did. And so, but that's okay, because that means that, you know, you have to become the self-reliant person you were always meant to be. You have to become that independent person. You can't rely on other people to solve your problems. You can't. You need a mentor. You need help, right? They can guide you. You need people that can guide you in the direction you need to go. And so the developing mindset is this, is this micro goal attaining process. You know, if someone can't even get out of bed, maybe the goal, like Dr. Peterson points out, maybe the goal is for them to just sit up in their bed and like pull out a magazine. Like, what's the next goal? Like, what is their tolerance level and what's the notch right above their tolerance level? Maybe going out for a walk for 10 minutes is better than what they did yesterday and the weeks before. Cleaning up parts of their house, attending to their immediate surroundings, to greatly help someone in their mental state of chaos. You have to attend. And that's what I did when I was overcoming anxiety. I spent a lot of my time cleaning my car, vacuuming, dusting, cleaning up my room, selling things in my room, minimizing my room, like straightening out my pictures, adding plants into my room. I just needed change. I was like reorganizing what I had in there, getting rid of clothes. I remember throwing out piles of clothes from my closet. I was just... If you're having trouble mentally, the best place to start is immediately, or like your surroundings. What would you like to minimize? You're going outside with your negative friends. You're going to the bar after work. Maybe go home and clean up, and then maybe one day when you feel good about that, it'll motivate you to go to the gym, because this process of hitting these targets, these micro goals, it actually builds on this energy. Remember before we talked about depressed people have this lack of energy, motivation. But when you hit these micro goals, it actually puts fuel back in the battery. And it motivates you to get to the next goal. Because if you read about someone like David Goggins, where he's at now, it's unbelievable. But when you study his life, he started from just getting up from the couch. He was like 300 pounds at the time. He ran a quarter mile down the road and he walked back home crying. And he sat back on his couch crying. And that's the guy who today we all know as the toughest man on the planet Earth. But his 100% was running 0.25 miles down the road. You know, his 100% was like maybe half an hour on the elliptical. Like he just by slowly stepping outside of your comfort, you discover your tolerance. But his mindset was like, well, if I keep attacking this tolerance, this 100% grows. It grows. Like, how much more am I capable of? How much more am I capable of? That's the growth mindset. So it starts with micro goals. And then archetypal stories. They help people who are suffering from anxiety and depression. Learning about philosophy. Learning about people like Marcus Aurelius, the disciplined mindset, or like stories that I talk about here, the biblical stories of Cain and Abel, or stories like Harry Potter or Luke Skywalker, and knowing kind of the psychological reasoning behind the hero's journey, like reading people like Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell, who talk about the hero's journey and why we all go through that, why the hero is within each of us, that it's not just in the movies that we watch. The reason why we like those movies so much is because they're a reflection of the human condition. And so generating kind of this narrative of, well, the hero archetype, because these heroes see challenge as opportunity rather than weight or a dead end. You know, I remember years ago when I was starting anxiety recovery, stumbling upon Wim Hof. And I looked at him as like his story is like a movie. I was blown away by his life story of everything that he accomplished and his transcendent mindset to suffering. And that's what we really want, is how to transcend suffering. The Buddha story, Siddhartha's story, why it resonates so much is because he lived in a comfort bubble and it was terrifying and debilitating, and learned helplessness was him at the time. But when he went out into the world, he discovered that there's suffering, dread, death, and it traumatizes him. It sends him into PTSD. He runs back home, can't stop ruminating over it. Something bit him, and it's at the forefront of his mind. But what he does is he goes back out, looks like, what's going on here? How can I rise above this? How do I deal with it? But what he does, it's so interesting, because you can't run from the thing that bit you. You have to study it, and it's going to be unpleasant. You got to look into it, the thing. You got to look into it. You got to see suffering. What is suffering? Can I overcome suffering? If I voluntarily place myself in suffering, could I actually be more than I am? And that's where I'm going to leave you today on this podcast episode. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. Anxiety, depression, it is not a dead end. Actually, it is the beginning of your new narrative. It's actually the beginning of your awakening. All the heroes, all the mentally strong people that you hear about, they started where you are. They started from their lowest points of existence. They started from depression, hopelessness. But the fact that they got to where they are is because they didn't want to settle. That's it. They just started from square one when nobody was talking about them, when they weren't on a podcast, when a book wasn't written about them. What were they doing? They were alone. They were alone, and they were stepping forth into the unknown. That's it. They were just stepping forth alone in this process of self-discovery. And hey, we all need to walk down that path. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Remember, rise above anxiety. And make sure you go to the YouTube channel. I post videos there weekly. Support the podcast there. Also, go over to Spotify. Leave a rating and review there. I'd greatly appreciate it. And I'll see you next time.
Brad's Powerful Anxiety Recovery Program is now available at unpluganxiety.com. The Anxiety Project Program is downloadable and puts the power of anxiety recovery in your own hands. Visit unpluganxiety.com for more details. Recovery starts now.